This is actually a special edition of The Rush, John Moore.
Very special.
Very special.
Rush. I don't know if there's going to be hugging and learning, though.
Oh, John, how long have you known me? There might be learning. I don't think they'll be hugging.
Okay.
John Moore and Deb Hutton coming to you this afternoon from the wonderful show home for the Princess Margaret Lottery up in King City. We're sitting in the dining room. The beautiful picture that they have on the dining room wall is of, I am pretending it's Amalfi in Italy. It looks very much like it. You see an Italian flag, but makes me feel like I want to be anywhere other than a cold place in Canada. But it is a beautiful show home. Joining us now, because it's after 4:30, are smart speakers. Scott Reed, CTV News political commentator and former communications director for Prime Minister Paul Martin, and Faye Johnstone, who is co-owner and executive director of consulting firm Wisdom to Action. Welcome back to The Rush. Let's get going. Let's talk about Pierre Poilievre's non-confidence motion. I think we're down to the last hour or so before we will see a vote. Scott Reed, I'm guessing there's going to be no surprises, but curious for your take on the politics of this non-confidence motion.
I think it's shrewd politics. I think that this motion elevates attention. Yesterday, Poilievre announces it. Because it's a non-confidence motion, it gets a little bit extra attention out of the media. It draws the Liberals into a forced conversation about the carbon tax yet again, makes them get up and defend it. Every time six cabinet ministers from Trudeau's government talk about the carbon tax, they offer seven or eight different explanations as to why it's in people's self-interest. It's obviously very unpopular. So if you can get your opponents talking about something that's super unpopular, that's wise if you're in the opposition. I'll say this. I thought his speech yesterday was a mistake. When he started talking about Poilievre gave this speech and he said, we could not have imagined Canada would be this kind of hell 8 years ago. And I think he's got to really dial back the rhetoric. He's got to watch those impulses to be too partisan, too critical, too severe, and frankly, to sound too much like Trump. They go crazy when you compare him to Trump. But if he's going to use that kind of Trump-esque language and rhetoric, the comparison is going to get made. So I think it's a smart tactic. I think he should dial back the rhetoric that he used yesterday.
Faye Johnstone, one of the things I observed about the politics of it, and I agree with everything, quite frankly, that Scott said, is what this says about Jagmeet Singh. Because I think at a certain point, people will be very, very upset that he continues to prop up the government.
You know, absolutely. I think it is putting him in a really tricky position. I think that, Pierre Poilievre is coming in with his, I would say, quite fake working class rhetoric, talking about those big corporate lobbyists and supporting workers and all that jazz. But I think he is drawing off New Democrat votes and also Liberal voters who in other situations might be looking to the NDP as an alternative option. But at the same time, I am tired of Poilievre's posturing on this. I understand that it's a political endeavor. I understand that the carbon rebate, carbon tax, whatever we're calling it today, is deeply unpopular. But, I can't help but remember that past conservative leaders have supported a tax on carbon. I can't help but remember that I haven't seen any alternative put forward by Poilievre to address the climate crisis that is going to screw over my generation and future generations. And so I get what he's doing. I just wish he would choose a better approach.
Faye, can we take a sidebar for a second? Because I understand you had a close encounter with Pierre Poilievre.
I did indeed. And he spoke with one trans person, maybe the first one in a couple, first one of his life. It was an experience.
Well, what did you talk about?
As you've heard me ramble on about before, we're seeing a whole lot of homophobia and transphobia coming back in to the Canadian context. And he himself has put his commented on access to gender affirming care for minors, supported the idea of forcing trans gals like me out of the only services and spaces that are there to support us in our moments of need. And so I went up to him and I was very nervous. Minister Sean Fraser was actually on the same flight. So it was a funny little meeting in the Halifax airport. And I told them, you know, I'm scared about the rise in hate. I think there's a lot of rhetoric in the air right now. And I actually think that, you know, my folks aren't always the best ambassadors talking about these issues, but that there's more common ground here. And there is a path forward that doesn't involve stomping down on the rights of my community.
Okay, let's jump to auto theft. A lot of developments in that department. For one thing, industry reps say that there's sort of an arms race for everything we come up with to try to make cars more secure and keep them in our driveways. The thieves are getting bolder and bolder and bolder. I found, and Scott, I'm going to start with you on this one, some of the stuff coming out of the from the police, almost useless, because they said, well, the feds have to do something. Okay, what could they possibly do? And then you have the opposition saying, just wait till we're in charge, we'll make sure car thieves go to jail.
Yeah, but you know, let's pick a different villain for today. Let's find fault with someone other than the police and the government. And this summit highlights it. Hugh Williams is somebody I've known for 100 years. We used to work together in Ottawa. I got a ton of respect for the guy, but you know, and he represents the car dealers. But he's one of the two industry representatives at the summit speaking and basically shrugging his shoulders, saying, "Well, there's no beating it." And you know, everything we've tried doesn't work. But I don't know, like, what in the hell have they tried? Between me and Deb, our vehicles have been stolen something like 33 times in 6 weeks. So, the truth of the matter is that manufacturers could offer options. They could do more. They could improve tracking and they could improve deterrence. But those things would be expensive. They would raise the cost of production. They therefore might raise the cost of retail, and they don't want to do them. So I sort of roll my eyes when I hear police say, you know what, put your keys at the front door, leave your door open, some cookies and a glass of milk like it's Christmas Eve for the car thieves. And the manufacturers say, oh my God, well, since organized crime got involved, there's nothing we can do. We haven't tried anything, but if we did, it would be pointless. I mean, could someone do something for Christ's sake? That's my ask.
All right. Over to you, Faye.
So I have the perfect solution. You know, I have a lovely vehicle. It sits in my driveway. I haven't turned it on in 4 years. It hasn't been able to turn on in 5. And so if you do something like that, I guarantee your rate of car theft is going to plummet in a great way. And then, as I've said before, if you discover this blessed service called public transit and use that to get around, there's no car to steal in the first place.
Yeah, but, you know, go ahead.
All of that aside, I think it would be great to see cops have to have a means of addressing this. This crisis, we've had auto theft ever since cars showed up. There must be a solution here. I'm not the one to say it. I don't know nothing about manufacturing or about how police address auto theft, but I think they're just passing the buck and hoping the problem goes away.
Okay, Deb, you're convinced that it's time to start going to these containers and popping them open and getting those cars back.
100%. John and I talked about this a little bit earlier, guys. I'll go back to you, Scott, on it. 80% of the cars stolen in Ontario are bound for the ports. They are leaving this country. The flip side is the case in the States. They're actually being, you know, more petty crime being stolen, and then they find them, as you found your car, Scott, not necessarily a big ring. So if we know that's how they're going, and by going, that's how they're making their money, then we cut off that hose. Scott?
It's not worth it. The ROI isn't worth it. I mean, nobody will say that out loud. You're never going to get a government minister to confess this. But what the CBESA would tell you is that if they could get $400 million more in budget, that's not what they would use it. And it would require a ton of manpower and scanning in order to go through all of those those containers. So, you know, that's the challenge, is that everybody looks at it and sort of shrugs their shoulders and says, there are solutions, but those solutions are not economical. Better to just bake in the cost of getting stuff stolen. And like, that is literally music to the ears of organized crime. Because they're like, no one's even trying to stop us. Talk about a victimless crime. Let's go. So I don't know. I don't know what the fix is, but it doesn't feel to me like anybody.
Oh, government cut off Scott just as he was about to criticize
the
them again. Scott Reed, Faye Johnstone, they'll continue with us after the break. And we're going to talk about the fact that fourplexes are no more in Ontario.
All right. I think we firmly established that I'm not going to the Hall of Fame. So might as well just keep kicking this thing around.
Oh, our smart speakers will save us, John Moore. You're listening to John Moore and Deb Hutton. And we're joined, thankfully, by Scott Reed, CTV News political commentator and former communications director for Prime Minister Paul Martin, and Faye Johnstone, who is co-owner and executive director of consulting firm Wisdom to Action. So I'm going to start with you on this one, Scott, because I know you're heading tomorrow on behalf of CTV News to Montreal to cover the funeral of our 18th Prime Minister, Brian Mulroney. Toronto Star had a column today by Linda McQuaig, and she made the case that he was good for corporate Canada and getting accolades for his free trade efforts, et cetera, but that he was very bad for workers in this country. Certainly entitled to her opinion. I could disagree with the column, but my real question isn't around the content. It's around the timing of, I used a word I had to get bleeped earlier, so let me be better about this.
I enjoyed it.
Crapping on a prime minister while he lies in repose today, tomorrow, funeral on Saturday. Prime ministers are fair game, I think, most of the time, except I would think this week, Scott, is in really bad taste to do a column like this.
Yeah, I agree. I have two beefs with the column. First of all, I think it's in poor taste because of the timing. And I know people will have different views on this, but, you know, I'm going to be at the funeral and doing the broadcast. And I know what my approach will not be. My approach will not be to litigate the entire career of Brian Mulroney on the day that people are bidding farewell to him, on the day that his family are placing their hand on his casket for the final time. I just don't, you know, there's an endless supply of days to debate his legacy going forward. So that's thing number one. I think it's in poor taste at this time. The second thing is, and you guys aren't adding this point, but I will, I don't think it's correct. So when the time has passed, I'm happy to have this argument. And, you know, I'm a liberal. I went to Ottawa, you know, in the early 90s to try to, like, defeat the government of Brian Mulroney. But I think that you can look at the overall legacy of free trade and argue that it actually generated a higher median income for a larger number of people. I think that it fundamentally altered the way that we trade, not just across North America, but internationally. And I think there were benefits. And yes, I think some of that neoliberal agenda, which I was part of when I was working for Paul Martin, ended up not fulfilling all of its promises. But I am not convinced that we're poor off as a country. So I think that column is wrong, and I think it was wrong to run it in the shadow of his funeral.
Man, my liberal friend has made me feel like a bad conservative because I didn't actually go after the content. But I agree with everything you just said, Scott. Faye Johnstone, I asked the question earlier of John Moore if I'm being too sensitive, because, of course, the prime minister is someone near and dear to my heart. I'll be attending the funeral on Saturday. I consider his daughter a good friend, but it was so distasteful for me to read that at this time. Your thoughts?
You know, I would agree on that piece in particular. You know, I was born in 95. I did not grow up under Mulroney by any means, and so my best learning on him has been reviewing the history books. Sorry to those who are a bit older on the call than I am. And, you know, I have some moments and you know, from what I've looked at, there are some things that he did that, you know, leave a bad taste in my mouth. But I also, you know, I admire the man. And I admire the era of politics that he was a juggernaut within. But even setting aside those criticisms, I would agree with, give the man a few weeks at the very least before we start tearing into his legacy. I think at the same time, there's a risk that we, like, you know, put him up on this giant pedestal and think of, you know, the politics of the days before. But I think, you know, he is a former prime minister. He deserves his moment and he deserves to be remembered for all of the good things he did, especially at this time.
So Scott Reed has made me feel like a bad conservative, and Faye, you've just made me feel old.
Okay, let's turn to housing and Doug Ford, for whatever reason, although maybe Scott Reed, you know, because I think there's a nicety between federal funding and this, you know, this program, but he's pushing for more houses, obviously, but nixing fourplexes. And I just don't get it. I mean, density's a part of this. You can't just build, well, we're sitting in one, but gigantic homes for one family.
Well, we know why. Why? Because Bonnie Crombie put forward a policy proposal on this. Look, I think Ford's wrong on the substance here, but I think he's going to be very careful with the politics, because this isn't NIMBYism. This is everywhere NIMBYism. Like, he's literally putting his finger on the scale and saying that the provincial policy will vehemently be to reward those who build big mansions and condo towers. And, you know, the challenge is that we have got to do a better job of building these low-rise multiplexes where people can and builders can affordably create homes that you can put 2-3 bedrooms in. You don't get that in a condo. And obviously the McMansions create all sorts of other challenges. There will always be McMansions. There will always be a buck to be made in building those big things. But this literally flies in the face of anything sensible. And I think Ford has got to be careful, because you can't be the champion of housing solutions and building solutions if you're going to say you're against these kind of proposals. Like, this is common sense. And I think that he's allowing partisan enthusiasm to get the better of him.
Yeah, Faye, I've always maintained that the better housing comes not through yet another single family home outside of Milton in a farm field. It's about building multiplexes in major urban areas where people want to live and work.
Absolutely. You know, I live in a townhouse, and it was the only home that I could afford when I purchased it, right? And so I think, you know, added density is in everyone's best interest, I would argue. And I think he does risk, you know, as Scott said, he can't be pro-housing and then against this. I also think that he's overestimating Bonnie's political, like, clout and capital in this space. Because if I had been him, I would have said, yeah, that's a great idea. I'm going to take it. I'm going to own it. I'm going to run with it. And we're going to build fourplexes everywhere. And I think he could have gotten away with that without it being understood as a liberal victory in any kind of a sense. And so I think it's a missed opportunity because he's not willing to cede an inch or even open that opportunity to the liberals when it would have been in Ontario's best interest. And I actually think in his political best interest, too.
Coming up in the 5 o'clock hour, John and I are going to break this issue down a little bit further and take some calls from our listeners on it, because it is a complicated issue in many ways. I agree with you know, some of the political analysis Scott and Faye have just made on it. But I mean, I think most people on the surface say fourplexes give more homes than threeplexes.
Yeah, I mean, even in our neighborhood, when they buy one of the 100-year-old single-family homes, they tear it down and build two or three. And that's, you know, I look at Bathurst Street and I can't believe this busy downtown in the core street is still all these single-family 150-year-old homes. I agree that they are homes to many, many people, but I think over time what we have to do is turn them into multiplexes.
A continued topic this afternoon. Scott Reed, CTV News political commentator and former communications director for Paul Martin. Faye Johnstone, co-owner and executive director of consulting firm Wisdom to Action. Always a pleasure, friends. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon on The Rush. When we come back, we will discuss some new news out of City Hall, paving over parking. What's the song that we should be singing? Joni
Pave
Mitchell?
Paradise Pave and put up paradise. A parking lot.
Exactly. It's the opposite this time.
It died a quick death.
You're listening to John Moore and Deb Hutton. We are at the Princess Margaret Lotto show home in King City with you for another hour. When we come back, we'll discuss this and so much more.